They just lived, experiment participant Randall Lacco reflected later. Another subject, known as KB in Pankey's notes, recalled that it left me with the completely unquestioned certainty that there is an environment bigger than the one I'm conscious of. Houston Smith, the future author of the best-selling The World's Religions, was also in the basement that Good Friday. While Smith had previously experimented with psilocybin, he considered the Marsh Chapel experiment his first direct personal encounter with God. "The most powerful cosmic homecoming I have ever experienced." One subject who received the psilocybin got up to deliver his own sermon, but only gibberish emerged from his mouth. Another became convinced that God had selected him to deliver the message that a messianic age was about to dawn, and 1,000 years of global peace were just around the corner. The subject raced down the chapel steps to Commonwealth Avenue, grabbed a letter from a postman, and crumpled it up, according to author Don Latton's reconstruction of the day. Whatever the letter contained, the subject surmised, was nothing compared to the message he had just received from God. The original Good Friday experiment is one of the preeminent psychedelic experiments in the scientific literature, Rick Doblin wrote in his 1991 follow-up study. Its fascinating and provocative conclusions strongly support the hypothesis that psychedelic drugs can help facilitate mystical experiences when used by religiously inclined people in a religious setting. In 1966, even Time raved about the trial's results. All students who had taken the drug experienced a mystical consciousness that resembled those described by saints and ascetics. "Psychedelics can definitely bring about religious experiences," Gunter Weil tells me. "They can stimulate a profound experience of spirituality. In this particular instance, these were divinity students, so the imagery and ritual in the chapel conveyed the Christian metaphor." Having said that, he adds, "I wouldn't go so far to say that it creates a permanent shift in consciousness. It opens the window to a possibility. You get a kind of preview of coming attractions." We get a preview of Alfred Omega's coming attractions in the final paragraphs of It Happened in Boston. What they actually represent isn't entirely clear, but think about it. There are hundreds of churches in Boston, and by some unconscious decision, Greenan concluded his novel about a tangible encounter with God in the exact location where scientists and drug-swallowing subjects attempted a startlingly similar feat. It happened in Boston. Chapter 10. Something in the Bricks. On September 11, 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. and the president of Boston University posed on the stone stairs of the school's Marsh Chapel for a photograph. King was at the peak of fame. A year earlier, he had delivered his "I Have a Dream" speech at the March on Washington. He would win the Nobel Peace Prize in December. As his star rose, threats of violence mounted, and King wanted his papers kept safe for posterity. His choice of institution, Boston University, where he had received his doctorate in theology in 1955. "I had the privilege of studying here for 3 years," King told a reporter, "and it was this university that meant so much to me in terms of the formulation of my thinking and the ideas that have guided my life." Boston was a second home to the Atlanta native. It was the city where he met his future wife, over lunch at Sheriff's on Mass Ave, and found a mentor in Howard Thurman, who conveyed to him Gandhi's belief in nonviolence as a force more positive than electricity. On April 5, 1968, thousands thronged outside that same church to mourn King, assassinated the day before in Memphis. The crowd spilled onto the sidewalk underneath a low gray sky. A few years ago, a young man walked up these steps and used our classrooms and read our books, Dean Robert Hamill pronounced. Today he walks no more on this plaza, or walks the streets of America. The world asks, what is happening in our land? Through the early part of the 20th century, Boston had a reputation as a racially progressive city, though contradictions were rife. The Puritans claimed to find slavery repugnant, but Massachusetts still played a vital role in the slave trade. The first colony to adopt slavery, Massachusetts was also the first state in the Union to abolish it. The Beacon Hill brownstone of escaped Kentucky slave Lewis Hayden became an important stop on the Underground Railroad, and it was in Boston that William Lloyd Garrison founded the New England Anti-Slavery Society, working alongside Frederick Douglass. After the Civil War, tensions developed between the growing number of Cotton Belt migrants and a small but influential group of black Brahmins on Beacon Hill. Disputes rose about everything from where to hang your laundry to the acceptability of throwing dice in the streets. To Boston-born blacks, the lesson was clear, J. Anthony Lucas wrote in Common Ground, his Pulitzer Prize-winning book about race relations in Boston. The newcomers were dragging them under, destroying their special relationship with whites. In the coming decades, the number of African Americans arriving in the Commonwealth continued to grow, soon far outnumbering the black Brahmins, moving into the brownstones of the South End and Roxbury. In the century between the end of the Civil War and 1968, the black population of Boston grew from 2% to 15%. Most of the increase was between 1940 and 1960, as whites moved to the suburbs. While the black population grew, opportunities did not. The only black people I saw were people who had mops, or were driving the elevator up and down, according to John Curtis Jones, who grew up in Roxbury in the 1940s. They were doormen, cab drivers, factory workers, and maybe working in the garage. By the spring of 1963, even those actively ignoring politics recognized that the civil rights movement had arrived in Boston. On the Common, 10,000 people marched to support the battle for equality unfolding in Birmingham, Alabama, led by King. Later that summer, the black population of Boston engaged in a one-day boycott of work, commerce, and public transportation to highlight discrimination. Since 1815, Boston had funded separate public schools for black and white students. Work to undo this segregation had begun in the mid-19th century, but now the movement had a new urgency. In September, Tom Atkins, Harvard graduate student and newly appointed Boston NAACP director, led protesters into the school department building on Beacon Street, where they demanded action. Louise Day Hicks and other Boston school committee members went about their day, pretending not to notice the protest, even as they had to physically step over African Americans in the hallways. Martin Luther King Jr. led a 22,000-person march on Boston in April 1965 to call attention to the civil rights work that the city desperately needed. Before the march, King toured Roxbury, routinely referred to as a slum by the Boston Globe, where the surge in black residents was inversely related to the property values and quality of city services. King told the crowd at Boston Common that the conditions in Roxbury were deplorable, but that he had come not to condemn, but instead to encourage this great city. The vision of the new Boston must extend into the heart of Roxbury, King said. School committee member Louise Day Hicks emerged as Kevin White's opponent in the 1967 mayoral election, running on the slogan, "You know where I stand," a dog whistle to racists and pro-segregation citizens. White defeated Hicks by a mere 12,000 votes. In his inaugural speech on New Year's Day, 1968, White echoed King in calling for a new Boston. But the voting results were clear. A large part of the city was fine with the old one. Mayor Kevin White was taking in a screening of 1939's Gone with the Wind when he got the news. Martin Luther King had been shot in Memphis. At City Hall, aide Barney Frank drafted an official statement. In 1968, the future congressman was a young, cigar-chomping, quick-witted political savant. The day of King's death, the Globe had profiled Frank as someone who had his finger in every pie. It was Barney Frank who reminded White that his predecessor's decision to send a sizable police force into Grove Hall the year before had been a disaster. In June 1967, a Mothers for Adequate Welfare demonstration turned into a weekend of riots and violent clashes with the police, injuring dozens. 44 people were arrested, including Tom Atkins. Instead, it was suggested, black community leaders should have a chance to visit troubled areas to encourage cooler heads to prevail. Some critics had nicknamed White Mayor Black for his focus on African-American issues, while others in the black community felt he had given them only the illusion of inclusion. Over at the Boston Tea Party, a milestone evening had become something else. Building on the success of its weekend shows, the club started booking Thursdays. The first night, April 4th, was to be christened by Muddy Waters, with Peter Wolfe's Hallucinations opening. "I never heard anything like it," manager Steve Nelson recalls. "This was like being at a wake in Muddy Waters' apartment or something, and everybody was crying." After an all-nighter at City Hall, Mayor White's mind raced with ideas to prevent the assassination from igniting violence. Looking over the day's list of concerts and theatrical offerings was the furthest thing from his sleep-deprived mind. But newly elected Boston Councilman Tom Atkins, the first African-American to hold that post in Boston in 17 years, had his eye on one show in particular. James Brown was scheduled to perform at the Boston Garden that evening. James Byrd, a DJ at Boston soul radio station WILD 1090 AM, had tipped Atkins off to the potential for trouble. "It's too late to cancel it. The word won't get around in time," Byrd said. "There'll be thousands of black teenagers down at the garden this evening, and when they find those gates are locked, they're going to be pretty pissed off." Atkins explained the precarious situation to White and Frank. James who? Neither had heard of him. But riots linked to concerts, that was something they were familiar with. History suggested that whether Brown's show was canceled or not, there might be trouble. It started in the spring of 1956. At a rock and roll dance at MIT, a student was badly injured, leading police to shut down a similar event the next week in Roxbury. When Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis hit Boston in May 1958, chaos erupted in the streets after the show when a group of 25 boys in identical satin jackets got rowdy. Papers claimed that the law-abiding youths suddenly became bedeviled into gangsterism and ran berserk. A sailor was stabbed. Dozens of others were beaten. The district attorney indicted show promoter Alan Freed under anti-anarchy laws, declaring he had unleashed a form of rock and roll paganism in Boston. Freed was eventually released, but Mayor John Hines had seen enough, grumbling, "These so-called musical programs are a disgrace and must be stopped. As far as I'm concerned, Boston has seen the last of them." After Hines left office in 1960, the total ban on rock shows lifted, save for some at the Boston Arena and the Boston Garden. City censor Richard J. Sinnott was in charge of figuring out if an act was rock and roll or not, and in turn, whether they could book a concert at those venues. The Beatles were allowed at the Garden, for instance, because they are not really R&R. As for the Beach Boys, Sinnott vacillated. "Some people have claimed that they're folk singers," he said. Whoever decided that James Brown was not rock and roll in 1968 had been woefully misinformed. What if the Brown concert was broadcast live on television? It was an audacious, nick-of-time proposal. No one remembers who came up with the idea, but some accounts point to Barney Frank. Each home viewer would be another person not on the street. WGBH was an obvious choice. The station had filmed Timothy Leary's 67 debate at MIT with a few hours' advance notice. David Atwood, who had manned the controls for What's Happening, Mr. Silver, jumped at the chance to direct the show. Everyone was happy with the plan, except James Brown. The morning of April 5th, the singer was in New York working on a TV special titled Man to Man. The show's contract dictated that Brown was not to participate in any other East Coast television appearances until after it aired a few months later. When Brown's New England representative, James Byrd, told Councilman Atkins the singer would likely be fine with this decision, he had no idea about the man-to-man clause. Greg Moses, Brown's manager, was livid when he found out about the telecast. Contract aside, Moses thought the live broadcast would kill the size of the Garden crowd, a blow to the performer's pocketbook and pride. Atkins told Mayor White that the city would need to cover the lost earnings from concert tickets, which seemed absurd, but what could he do? With each passing hour, the city's immediate fate seemed to hinge upon the details of James Brown's live show. It was Friday. A wrong move that night would trigger a weekend of unrest. At last, White agreed, but demanded circumspection. If word ever gets out we underwrote a goddamn rock star with city money, we'll both be dead politically, he said to Atkins. Meanwhile, White assured the citizens of Boston that the situation was under control. He appeared on a WGBH program hosted by Lewis Lyons, a salty old New Englander who had nearly broken down on air speaking about King's death the night before. White said that the city was working closely with the Negro leadership of Roxbury and that there was reason for apprehension but not alarm. That evening's memorial event, White said, would allow people to let off some steam. I hope we're going to weather this, he solemnly remarked. Impromptu vigils popped up on Boston Common, Post Office Square, and in front of Marsh Chapel. National Guard units went on standby. Inside the Boston Garden, Atwood and his WGBH crew set up three cameras, two in the balcony, one from behind the stage, so that they could cut to Brown's perspective. Outside, a young concertgoer approached a policeman and asked whether the show was still on. Yeah, the cop replied. But if I were you, I wouldn't come. It could be a little edgy in there. You can get a refund. There was a certain irony in pinning the hopes of civic peace on a performer as notoriously hot-tempered as Brown, who had once showed up at a Georgian nightclub to fire shotgun rounds at a musical rival who had mocked his signature cape routine on stage. Still, many in the black community did look up to him as a role model and a civil rights spokesperson. To Brown, black power meant black pride and black people owning businesses and having a voice in politics, as he wrote in his 1986 autobiography. I wanted to see people free, but I didn't see any reason for us to kill each other. Atkins and Brown discussed possible solutions on the drive from Logan Airport. While inside the garden, musicians and the WGBH team both got ready. If the city of Boston would cover his financial losses, Atkins finally suggested, then perhaps Brown could alter the clause in his man-to-man contract? The singer had done some calculations. He was poised to lose $60,000 that night. Atkins had persuaded the mayor to cover the difference, but no one had imagined a figure so substantial. With this promise in place, Brown gave WGBH the okay to air his concert live. The singer even talked to fans before curtain, telling them it didn't make sense to turn their rage over Dr. King's death into a riot at a concert. The mayor arrived at 6 and finally met Brown. Later, White would describe the encounter as a collision between two arrogant people. In the one photo of White, Brown, and Atkins backstage at the Garden, the mayor appears to lecture the other two men. "I'll get you your money," White promised the singer, "but I want you to get up on that stage and put on a performance. I don't mean a musical one, either." What Mayor White definitely did not tell James Brown backstage was that the city simply did not have the money to pay him $60,000. He'd worry about that later. Right now, all that mattered was that the show work some kind of miracle. Ladies and gentlemen, apologies. We're still waiting for the audio connection to the Boston Garden for the memorial concert this evening, featuring Negro singer Jimmy Brown and his group, WGBH announcer Bill Pierce explained to those tuning in. Co-hosting the concert will be Mayor Kevin White. That's coming up next on this station. The time, 8:30. As rioting in D.C. came within a few blocks of the White House, James Brown took the stage in front of approximately 1,500 souls and launched into "If I Rule the World," a vision of a better life for everyone. Then Atkins addressed the crowd in the Garden and at home. He's been doing some things around the country where, if other people were to join with him, would make a big difference, the councilman said, as Brown stood behind him with his arms behind his back. When Atkins suggested people send in donations to the Martin Luther King Trust Fund to City Hall, Brown applauded, and so did the audience. As the councilman reverently introduced Kevin White, Brown realized that the tone was all wrong. This was a concert, not a campaign stop. As Brown grabbed the microphone from Atkins, the surprised councilman exclaimed, "Wait a minute." But Brown knew what he was doing. "I had the pleasure of meeting him," Brown said, in a tone his fans could relate to, "and this is a swinging cat. Mayor Kevin White, give him a big round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. He's a swinging cat." White, who had mistakenly referred to the singer as James Washington all afternoon, allegedly asked an aide to remind him of the actual name just before walking out on stage. White reminded the audience that they were at the Garden to listen to a great talent, James Brown. James Brown laughed as the audience cheered. "But we're also here to pay tribute to one of the greatest Americans, Dr. Martin Luther King," White continued. 24 hours ago, Dr. King died, for all of us, black and white. Now he directly petitioned his city not to riot, without using that word. Stay with me as your mayor to make Dr. King's dreams a reality in Boston. The audience was slower to clap at this, so Brown got it going for them, maybe the only time in his career where he played onstage hype man for a white person. "He's a young man, you dig?" Brown told his fans as the mayor left the stage. "So he's thinking together." With the night's all-important business concluded, Brown proceeded to do what he did best, deliver one of the best live shows anywhere on the planet, anywhere in time. "It's getting late in the evening," he sang, teasing out the intro to That's Life, a 1963 song made famous by Frank Sinatra. With its eerily off-by-a-month lyrics, "You're riding high in April, shot down in May," it was a potentially chilling opener. But the crowd was too happy to notice, gasping as Brown did his first 360-degree spin of the night. Even though upbeat numbers dominated the set, you could hear something mournful in Brown's cathartic wailings. He was a man who knew how to express the utterances and the screams and the feelings of a whole people, Al Sharpton would later comment about the show. In the wings, Marva Whitney, a featured vocalist who was also Brown's girlfriend, prayed for everyone's safety as she waited her turn. Reports started rolling in from police officers all around the city. Boston was a ghost town. This concert was like magic, Tom Atkins recalled. The city was quieter than it would have been on an ordinary Friday night. This was true even at 53 Berkeley Street, where the Amboy Dukes, a Detroit band led by guitarist Ted Nugent, played for a near-empty house at the Tea Party. Marva Whitney performed four songs while Brown changed outfits backstage. Then saxophonist Maceo Parker announced that the city was very quiet and calm. The reports also say that everyone is home watching the TV program, he said, hailing the show and its broadcast as a big success. Brown reappeared, clad in a blazer, and ripped into Get It Together. Had the mission already succeeded? Was it too early to declare victory? The band blasted through its second set with urgency. That Friday night, a repertoire of songs consisting of two-chord vamps and only a handful of repeated lyrics vibrated with an extra hypnotic quality. Brown's inspired electric fits of dance between verses took the place of guitar solos, and at times he appeared to float across the stage. His musicians, trained not to take their eyes off Soul Brother No. 1, accentuated Brown's dramatic movements with an extra snare hit or burst of saxophone. To get the band to cut the heat, the singer would suddenly freeze, hands in the air in a motion of surrender. He would typically close his shows draped in a sequined cape, escorted slowly to the wings by a handler as though against his will. It signaled that the performer would give it his all, would just keep going if it were up to him. The only reason I stay alive is because my team knows when to get the cape and drag me off stage. On April 5th, the cape routine was especially magnetic, drawing young fans to clamber onto the stage. One of Brown's entourage managed to push the first kid off, but suddenly a contingent of Boston police officers, nearly all white, swarmed the stage and forced back the surge. Inside WGBH's mobile broadcast unit, David Atwood was getting worried. At some point in the proceedings, the station had decided to re-air the concert immediately upon conclusion. But now that things were deteriorating, Atwood questioned the plan. That was really tense, Atwood recalls. Is this going to turn into a major riot? I held back visually, trying to walk this fine line between showing what was going on and not trying to overshow what was going on. If a riot was about to go down, should WGBH keep airing the concert? Brown whispered to the man with the cape, who folded it up and briskly left. The band segued into the closing song, I Can't Stand Myself, When You Touch Me. After another interaction with a stage jumper and a Boston cop, Brown called off the band mid-riff. Wait a minute, he shouted. I'll be all right. I'll be fine. As Brown asked the police to clear the stage, the crowd cheered wildly. One kid, then two, then six, now surrounded the singer. As police reemerged, Brown insisted, Wait a minute! They're all right! It's all right! The phrases sounded like signature Brown lyrics, now shouted without any music behind them. Amid the chaos, the house lights came up. Let me finish the show for everyone else, Brown said. We got a show where young men and young ladies... Wait a minute! Wait a minute! Atwood cut to the rear-view shot as Brown, who sounded angry for the first time all evening, yells, Now, we are black. Can't you all go back down and let's do the show together? We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing the show. Another fist-pumping audience member, unaware that the time for games had long passed, approached Brown. You made me look very bad, 'cause I asked the police to step back and you wouldn't go down. No, that's wrong. It's wrong. You're not being fair to me, yourself, or your race. Now, I asked the police to step back because I thought I could get some respect from my own people. don't make sense. Now, are we together or we ain't? The crowd cheered in the affirmative. Suddenly the stage was clear again. An agitated Brown turned back to drummer Clyde Stubblefield and ordered, "Hit the thing, man." The house lights went back down. "Good God," Brown howled in the spotlight, "can't stand your love." Strobes, bows, handshakes. Then it was done. In just a moment, we're going to do something rather wild for television, WGBH's Bill Pierce announced. If you have any friends who would have enjoyed tonight's concert at the Boston Garden, won't you tell them that we're going to repeat the show right now? As the band rolled out of town on the tour bus, they couldn't believe what just happened. The musicians had assumed that the show would end in a ball of fire. That night, major rioting hit more than 100 American cities, with places like Detroit, Chicago, Baltimore, and D.C. bearing the brunt. Dozens died, 20,000 arrests were made, and damage estimates reached $45 million. In Boston, by contrast, the disturbances were surprisingly minor, especially for a city with so much racial tension. Marva Whitney would later say that Brown's performance that night did not come without a cost. I know James went through something mentally. He knew whether it went down wrong, bad, or indifferent, whatever, he knew that he would get blamed for it. To tell you the truth, I was glad when we got out of there. On Monday morning, recovering from a 103-degree fever, Tom Atkins heard that the city might be wriggling out of its promised payout to Brown. The councilman threatened to publicize the news if Mayor White didn't make good on his word. But White wasn't exaggerating. The city didn't have the funds to write out a simple treasury check. The mayor approached the so-called vault, a group of powerful old Boston money men who, behind the scenes, had been fixing potential catastrophes since the late 1950s, when the city was on the verge of bankruptcy. They balked upon hearing White's unusual request for a payout to Brown. "Well, the city is at stake here," he told them flatly. "So whatever you think you can do." By the time he walked back to City Hall, a sum of money had been extended to deal with the issue. Some reports say far less than $60,000 was earmarked for the singer. According to J. Anthony Lucas, the city had pressured the Garden to waive its share of the receipts that night, which reduced the city's bill to Brown to $15,000. A close Brown associate, Charles Bobbitt, claims they were never paid more than $10,000. In Bobbitt's telling, when he told Brown about the missing money, the singer shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, we're doing a good thing." Mayor White, in a 2008 documentary, repeats the old figure, "It was worth the $60,000." That spring and summer, people came together en masse. In a stadium in Roxbury, on the Common, by Arlington Street Church and Marsh Chapel. Faced with the rising body count in Vietnam and assassinations at home, the public assembled to grieve, meditate, connect. On the evening of April 4th, Robert F. Kennedy had memorialized King to an Indianapolis crowd while on the campaign trail. 2 months later, he too was gone. As political scientist Ross Baker later noted, the two killings seemed to make a compelling argument to many that the peaceful path was a dead end and that the resort to violence was now acceptable. Eerie headlines. Did King earlier have premonition of death? Pumped up the terror. On The Tonight Show, Truman Capote told Johnny Carson that the turmoil was part of an occult plan to overthrow the American government. For over a year, students had regularly gathered in Boston Common to protest the war and support the civil rights movement. But that summer, something strange happened. A large contingent of young people simply started living there. In hippievilles around the country, the Globe reported in June, the word is out. See you in Bosstown this summer. The article predicted that dropouts would be migrating from all over the country to grab a piece of public lawn. An accurate forecast. The only dip in the Commons' population growth that summer was due to a rampant rumor that an asteroid named Icarus was going to destroy the Earth's population mid-June, and only two locations would be spared, Tibet and Colorado. No one knows how the rumor started, but American hippies flocked to Colorado en masse. At an observatory in Cambridge, employees fielded frantic calls about Icarus. "The space kooks really came out of the woodwork," a spokesman for the observatory told the Globe. Some MIT students dreamed up a contingency plan involving 9 nuclear-tipped Saturn rockets borrowed from the U.S. Moon Program. Icarus missed Earth by 4 million miles. As the hot weather sets in, they frolic in the frog pond or listen to rock concerts by such groups as the Ultimate Spinach, Time reported. In June, the hippies declared they wanted to clean up the common and its surroundings, so the Parks Department issued rakes, shovels, and a nearby lot where they could grow vegetables. They grew marijuana instead. For Mayor White and his trusted aide, Barney Frank, the hippies on the common were fairly low on their list of priorities, but soon phone calls from freaked-out parents captured their attention. The flip side of the story developing on the common was a rash of young runaways from the suburbs. In the summer of 1968, if a teenager ran away in the Boston area, they were likely to end up at the common or up on Fort Hill. There was a cult issue up on Fort Hill with children disappearing, Frank says. But he was wise enough to recognize that direct police intervention there would only galvanize a group like that. It certainly worked out that way in regard to the Avatar obscenity trials. Instead, Frank addressed that trouble spot by having a private meeting with Fort Hill community member Lewis Crampton, encouraging him to consider turning young runaways away from the family. This talk didn't seem to make much difference. To wit, the 18-year-old daughter of a Harvard Law School professor arrived with some friends on Fort Hill a year later in 1969. That daughter, Eve Chase, would become pregnant by Mel Lyman shortly after moving there, subsequently taking on his last name, though their marriage ceremony at the time was not of the legal sort. As the Commons' full-time residence grew, the mayor instituted a midnight curfew, which took effect on June 28th. The hippies, White said, are no longer a novelty. Barney Frank hired a kind of hippie whisperer, Dr. Stanley Klein, to be a full-time presence on the common, both to try to understand the community's way of life and to offer help to those who needed it. After a June 29th protest of the curfew erupted into violence, Judge Elijah Adlow, fresh off sparring over the artistic merits of the Avatar newspaper, began sentencing squatters, explaining that he would not allow the common to become a flophouse. "You've made a disaster area out of what used to be the most beautiful part of Boston," he told a courtroom full of longhairs. "These kids were merely looking for something," the defense insisted. Adlow told them they weren't going to find it at the corner of Charles and Beacon. The media latched onto the summer of the hippie as a lighter alternative to the coverage of the other major youth story unfolding at that time, protesting the Vietnam War. Since 1964, the draft had come to resemble a lottery of death, plucking young men out of their communities, dropping them into danger a world away. More than 11,000 U.S. servicemen had died in 1967, a tally that 68 was set to top. The brutal imagery of the Tet Offensive, piped into American homes early that year, gave even the staunchest hawks pause. Belief in the illegality and immorality of the war moved from the fringes toward the mainstream. For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate, CBS anchor Walter Cronkite told his viewers. To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe in the face of the evidence the optimists who have been wrong in the past. Those under 26 hoping to dodge the draft could do it legally by hiring lawyers to find loopholes, or illegally by faking an undesirable condition or simply not showing up. Fort Hill's Michael Kindman put together a strategy based on stories of community members who had done it before. I woke up and took a small dose of LSD to make sure I would be a little disorientated and uninhibited, he wrote. I volunteered that I was both gay and a communist, and was unresponsive to the psychological interviewer. He made it clear I was not the kind of person they were looking for. For musician Ted Myers of the band Chameleon Church, staying awake on speed for a solid week before his selective service physical did the trick. He told the examiner he wanted a gun to kill some people. They called me weirdo and faggot, he says. The docs didn't even make me drop my pants. Boston became an epicenter for Vietnam War resistance, perhaps because of its role as the birthplace of the American Revolution, or its proximity to Concord, where Henry David Thoreau had written on civil disobedience a century earlier. You could just feel it, one activist remarked. There was something in the bricks. At a protest on the common, an older attendee declared what marketers at MGM Records, DJs on WBCN, and the prognosticators on Fort Hill had been claiming all year. Boston and New England will once again be the beginning point and inspiration for a second and badly needed American Revolution. Among the most passionate anti-war activists were area professors, including MIT's Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn at Boston University. I don't believe we owe loyalty to a government that lies to us, Zinn, a World War II veteran, told a crowd at the Common. I do believe we owe loyalty to our fellow Americans who are in danger of being killed by the incompetence of this government. Ray Mungo was one of many BU students under the sway of Zinn. While other teachers might sign a petition, Howard would join the sit-in, Mungo says. He put his body on the line. Zinn was a close mentor to the group of BU resistors, who often had breakfast at his house. Short and bespectacled, Mungo seemed wise beyond his years, and made vivid moving appearances on What's Happening, Mr. Silver. He deluged Avatar with letters until they finally put the dynamic demonstrator on the cover. Though Mungo got along with Mel Lyman, he resisted attempts to get him to join Fort Hill. Meanwhile, issues of Avatar were finding their way to servicemen in Vietnam, some of whom sent letters back. There are a lot of people who don't want to be here, one such letter explains. But what should we do? Drop out? Then every little pissy-ass country going will want to test this country and its ideals, which allow people like you and me to say what we want, when we want. His editorial direction at BU News was so inflammatory that the university threatened to withdraw its financial support for the troublemaking paper. The nation's only college paper with its own reportorial staff in Vietnam, Mungo noted. With his friend, Marshall Bloom, he founded the Liberation News Service in 1967, a kind of anti-war AP wire service, one that could reach millions of readers without having any power and very little money, Mungo says. We made everyone a media. By the summer of 1968, the Liberation News Service became enough of a federal annoyance to warrant an infiltration by members of the FBI. The undercover agents divided and conquered the organization by writing and distributing a finger-pointing manifesto full of insider information entitled, "And Who Got the Cookie Jar?" In fact, many underground and student newspapers in Boston received visits from the FBI in the late 60s, including Avatar. When feds visited the office at 37 Rutland Street, Avatar editor Wayne Hansen let them search the location freely, and they left soon afterward. Outside, Hansen found the agents trying to get into their own car with a coat hanger, their keys locked inside. He walked over to the scene with his camera, but the agents begged him not to take pictures, which he obliged. By the time the FBI arrived at BU News, word had gotten out. Alex Jack, an editor at the paper, had prepared some materials in preparation for their visit. "Thank you for coming. I just have a few questions," Jack told the agents, and handed them a 3-page questionnaire. As they left in a huff, other students followed them to their car, pretending to take notes on their every move and muttering, "Ah, yes, very interesting." It was a brutal summer for the resistance. In May, 4 of the Boston Five, local men who had been charged with aiding draft resistors, were found guilty of conspiracy in a trial that the prosecuting attorney described as more exciting than skydiving. Now it appeared that the most trusted advisor of early parenthood, Dr. Benjamin Spock, was headed to prison. In early June, a weird and dirty-looking young couple walked into Boston's Selective Service office and poured black paint into file cabinets, making portions of the database unreadable. They were charged and found guilty in October. In July, the stabbing of 2 servicemen on the common went down late one Tuesday night, marking a turning point in what was previously considered a fairly light-hearted phenomenon. When chanting hippies disrupted Vice President Hubert Humphrey's downtown presidential rally in late September, Mayor White's patience finally ran out. The media claimed he ordered a police war on the protesters. Arrests piled up, and the Commons grass was conveniently scheduled to be torn up for routine maintenance. The summer of the hippie was coming to an end. By the time the Common curfew was found to be illegal in Suffolk Superior Court in December 1968, the cold weather had made the issue moot. James Brown's Boston Garden Show certainly prevented an immediate wave of violence from sweeping over the city, but it was not as if racial tensions simply evaporated. Mayor White's sigh of relief lasted approximately a day. On Sunday, April 7th, the United Front, a coalition of nearly every black organization in the city, was organized and ratified. On Monday, 5,000 people convened at White Stadium in Roxbury. No whites allowed. United Front representatives read aloud 21 demands, most strikingly, a call for immediate black ownership and black leadership at all businesses and schools in their communities, as well as renaming schools and other institutions after heroes of the movement. The language was startling. As of 12 a.m. Monday, April 8, 1968, all white-owned and white-controlled businesses will be closed until further notice, while the transfer of the ownership of these businesses to the black community is being negotiated through the United Front. Lastly, the UF stated that the mayor needed to make $100 million available to the black community. The demands incensed Mayor White. He voiced his support for the NAACP's recommendations for Boston, which had been crafted and delivered after the NAACP and UF separated their efforts in the wake of King's death. Councilman Tom Atkins was upset by Mayor White's swift rejection of the United Front, adding, "Neither this mayor nor any other mayor can decide what part of the black community he is going to deal with. And for the mayor to say that he will receive suggestions from one group and not from another is the epitome of stupidity." Less than a week ago, they had been applauding each other on stage at the Boston Garden. Now they were trading barbs in the press. The Globe, reporting on why the UF felt justified in their gigantic ask, noted that some black intellectuals compare Roxbury to a colony, where the economy is controlled from without by a colonial government. Over in Franklin Park, whose greenery covered parts of Dorchester, Jamaica Plain, and Roxbury, the American flag was lowered and the black nationalist flag was raised, Skip Asheim reported in Avatar. Keep your eyes open, Avatar announced. The first phase in the liberation of Roxbury has begun. Up on the hill, the Mel Lyman family braced for what might happen in Roxbury after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. Even as Avatar ran stories blasting institutionalized racism, there was friction between the Fort Hill community and residents of the predominantly black neighborhood, where Lyman had put down stakes in 1966. For over a year before King's death, the family posted armed guards to send a message that they weren't going anywhere. The hill was locked down that April, a neighbor, Allison Burke, recalls. The police basically left our part of Roxbury to vigilante control. In the early summer of 1968, the group of black men who patrolled parts of Roxbury, often running into Lyman's Fort Hill patrol, suddenly had an official name, the Black Panthers. Founded 2 years earlier in Oakland, California, the Black Panther Party focused on monitoring and challenging police brutality. Soon, FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover would call Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale's volunteer army of young black men in leather jackets and berets the greatest threat to the internal security of the country. The party's fifth chapter opened in Boston. Delano Farrar, a Northeastern University student, opened two Panther headquarters in Roxbury. The group plastered the South End and Roxbury with posters, gave Avatar street hawkers a run for their money with its own newspaper, started a breakfast program for kids, and opened a free health clinic. The Panthers call their breakfast program socialism, the Globe wrote. Others consider it charity. Still others consider it indoctrination. We are 24-hour revolutionaries dedicated to the needs of black people, Farrar declared in response. Their health clinic, a trailer stationed on Tremont Street in the South End, was soon riddled with bullets. Shot by local cops, the Panthers claimed. At some point, Boston's Black Panthers became interested in all the white people living on Fort Avenue Terrace, acting like Highland Park was their private property. From the Panther perspective, these folk music-loving weirdos ought to move to a different part of the city and return the neighborhood to the black community. Jesse Benton recalled the community receiving a message that the Panthers were planning to set fire to their houses to clear them out of Fort Hill. Benton would sit inside and make sure they could see the glint off the rifle on the window. I certainly don't pretend all races are the same, Lyman told Rolling Stone. Ever since I was a kid, I've had trouble with Jews. But I also believe a man of any nationality can rise above that nationality, can put that nationality to use. I like to talk in topical languages 'cause people can get into it. Like I might say something like, all niggers are stupid, you know? Just to wake people up, get them involved. When pressed on any of his controversial statements, including similar homophobic remarks, Lyman would dodge the charge by claiming that their ability to shake people into the present moment justified the slurs as a means to an end. Lyman sent out word that he'd rather negotiate. But on the appointed day, he sent his wife in his place. It was a political move, of course, that Mel sent a woman and didn't come himself, Jesse Benton recalls. There were several of the men with me who were all packing. Nevertheless, a truce was forged, and tensions between the two groups subsided. As a kind of indirect response to the United Front's 21 demands, Mayor White earmarked $56 million to aid Boston's black community in May 1968. The UF promptly blasted the measure as an insult to the black community, planned with zero input from the people it meant to help. The full effects of White's May 68 decisions would take years to play out, but each remaining month of that turbulent year would contain its own set of racial confrontations, many of them unexpected victories for the civil rights movement. In late April, black students at Boston University seized an administration building to call attention to the 14 urgent demands they had for the school. After a 12-hour standoff, the administration conceded to all of them, most based around the promise of more black students and scholarships at BU, except for the request to rename a building after Martin Luther King. And in the wake of airing the James Brown concert, WGBH replaced What's Happening, Mr. Silver, with Say Brother. Included will be news from the ghetto, interviews with black people, the WGBH press release read, and a forum for all shades of Negro opinion. The tone-deaf description belied the show's outspoken content, such as the round table in which a local artist said, "There is great talent in the black community. We know this because white people are constantly stealing everything we have and packaging it and calling it whiteness." Say Brother was hosted by James Spruill, a Brandeis graduate and actor who had lived with Mel Lyman, Charles Giuliano, and John Kostick in Waltham in the early 60s. Spruill would also found a theater company for black artists in the fall of that year. There must be a black theater for the black community, our own voices in our own playwrights, and the more black rage, the better, he told an interviewer. Black people refuse to go around not being recognized anymore. Thinking along similar lines, Charles M. Holly and John Curtis Jones started Black Music, Inc. in late 68, with the intent of passing out shares to ordinary citizens in Roxbury. Instead of one black performer becoming extremely wealthy, and instead of allowing whites to rip off black artists, the setup would let the black community become invested in the production of their music. Black Music soon blossomed into more than a record company. After Reepin and Don Law moved the Boston Tea Party, Holly and Curtis snatched up the lease and opened a private club, The Common Ground, in September 1969. For $15 a year, anyone could hang out and make music at 53 Berkeley Street, 5 days a week. Black Music, Inc. not only grabbed the lease on the FHC's former Filmmaker Cinematheque locale, they were also poised to move into the middle of their commune. Around this time period, the owner of 4 Fort Avenue Terrace wanted to remove the Lyman residence and sell the building to Holly and Jones. But because the Fort Hill community had taken a crumbling house and turned it into a well-constructed, vital part of their commune, the idea of the original owner profiting off their hard work and of someone outside the family living in the center of their commune drove members so crazy that they began dismantling the building from the inside during the middle of the night. When the owner was about to sell to Black Music, Inc., she discovered that where plumbing, walls, and floors had existed the week before, now there was just an empty shell. A former member of the community explained to Rolling Stone what happened next. Naturally, the neighborhood became enraged. There was a meeting between Black Music, Inc. and Fort Hill, sort of as a prevention of war. A bunch of our guys went down there, and I remember at one point we said, "Okay, if you want a war, we'll give it to you." And as I say, we were ready. We had guns and everything. When the frustrated owner of 4 Fort Avenue Terrace finally sold the house at a bargain price to the Fort Hill community, the first thing they did was raze the property to the ground. Bewildered, Rolling Stone's David Felton asked why. An anonymous source replied, "The point is, you see, we live for the moment." Michael Kindman recalled the saga of Number 4 going like so. During the negotiation process, Mel had a dream one night about fighting with Lena, the landlady. In the dream, he was hitting Lena on the head. Awake the next day, he interpreted this as an instruction to damage the roof of the house so it would lose its value and she would be more ready to sell. One family member, Ed Fox, said in 1968, "Black power is beautiful, man, and it's good for Negroes to do their thing. But we're into our own scene. They're parallel movements." It sounded supportive, but it also sounded a lot like the same old call for segregation cloaked in hippie garb. This brand of casual racism would pale in comparison to the overt racism that awaited the city. The legal battle over school busing in the mid-1970s would turn South Boston into a hate